All right, welcome everyone. Let's see if we just see we have Duncan online. You, at least one, two, three folks calling in. So just give it a moment to see if others can join. All right, stable three members of the public calling in. So welcome everyone. This is meeting 11 of the Demand Management Working Group. And so we'll just get started right away. Again, since folks are calling in, just primarily one voice at a time, and if you can also state your name before you begin. When you're speaking, I can demonstrate. This is Stephanie Corey with the Consensus Building Institute serving as facilitator. What we'd like to do is get started just doing a meeting recap reminder of what we did last time and tiny font, but two main points of discussion. One, we were looking at some specific demand management actions last time, and so as part of that, and so we were exploring things like what could be a fee-based trigger approach, how might you do some polygon grouping, and so one of the outcomes that we're going to explore today is kind of doing a bit of a deep dive into the data that and how that kind of works with a polygon grouping. So that's what we're going to go over today. Eddie from Ludorf did a overview of an introductory preview of the Demand Management Framework technical report. And so that went through staff review, and then it was shared with this group, and I believe CSAT as well, right? Okay. And so we'll do...
Actually, no, CSGSA.
Oh, CSGSA. Sorry. Okay, so not... But I believe it's on the agenda for the next CSAT meeting. Okay. So we'll do another quick overview, high-level overview of that today. And then we at the very end of the last meeting, we also did a bit of the what some of the upcoming outreach and engagement plans were. So that's what we did last time. Just status review of where we are. We are in that, just we're developing ideas and refining things. So, as I mentioned, that two for two today, it's the we'll do a high level overview of the framework technical report that was shared. And then we will spend a good hour focused on doing that deep dive into the demand management actions. So that is the primary thing, trying to keep it to just an hour and a half today. But any questions before we dive in? All right, then let's go. So thought was that we had Justin will give an overview of kind of a brief reminder and overview of the technical report, and we do have Duncan from ERA calling in to be able to answer and clarify questions. But we'll turn it over to Justin.
Yeah, can you bring me up the first little bit of the document? Bits. All right, cool. So, the key here, in fact, is to give you guys an opportunity right now to ask Duncan any questions. I know that this is a relatively thick document with a lot of data and information within it. And it might take a couple rounds of looking at it to come up with any realistic questions, but we have them here today in case anybody looked through it and something stuck their mind as something they want to talk about. Ultimately, let's talk a little bit about, what's in it. I think we had these conversations before. The easiest way to get a feel for what is contained within the document is to sort of go through this, summary in the beginning, right? It does have a summary up front, which gives you an idea of the entirety of the document as a whole, and also might give you an idea of the specific parts that you may want to delve into yourself if they are important to you. The one thing that this sort of thing intends to do is to give the background, right? And then give the potentials. So many of you know a lot about the background and the conditions already, and you may want to concentrate your efforts on those potentials and what it looks like could happen. Ultimately, it's my feel that this document will be useful as we move forward in the southern part of the county when we start to work with CSGSA to create to create programs that are associated with Glenn County. Ultimately, we want them to be at least somewhat close to each other, and we want to be able to use something like this as a baseline to work together to make that happen. If you look in here at the sort of straw proposals, they aren't significantly out of line with what we are doing and talking about now. It's a relatively similar tract in a lot of ways, or could be relational, depending on, ultimately some of the finite details. There might be some differences, but close in that regard. And you can see that they have some discussion about, some of those incentive-driven conversations that might be a little bit more detailed than I gave in my write-up bit that will help us sort of narrow some of that stuff down. But also, as you notice, there are mandatory components to the program as well. So I guess really what the point is today is to give you guys the opportunity to ask questions. So if you have anything that you would like to hear Duncan talk about specifically, now is your chance to ask those questions. With that, hey, this thing's big. If we want time to delve into it further, that's okay. But ultimately, this is that start.
So we'll go to Duncan just in a moment, just see if he has anything to add. Right, like, as we mentioned, the Cornington Basin Advisory Board, their next regular meeting is August 6th, which is the afternoon of this group's. This group is meeting in the morning on August 6th, and then the CSAP is meeting later in the afternoon. So that's that the this technical report is on the agenda, I believe, for that CSAP meeting. Duncan, anything else that you want to add, though, to Justin's comments?
Sure, just briefly, and good morning, committee members. Thanks for letting me tune in virtually here. I think Justin and Stephanie did a pretty good high-level overview. I just want to emphasize again that it is a dense document because, as you all know, demand management, especially for groundwater, is a tough topic, politically, technically, economically. And I just emphasize that, like, the first 9 pages of the document, the executive summary, do boil everything down into the key pieces. So, like, it's a digestible document if you just if you focus on that first executive summary section, and then you can drill down and look, into the pages if you want to get more details on what it would take to set up a fallow bank program or some of these voluntary incentive-driven conservation programs, how you might fund them and what type of administrative structure would be needed for those. And then I think the other thing I'd point out is that, this is, Stephanie mentioned, I guess this is the 11th meeting you've held. ERA has only been part of the last handful of those, but this document reflects, my notes and discussion, as well as those with David's Engineering and LSCE in the meetings that I've attended. So it should incorporate your feedback in how an effective program design should look, and then add some additional color for technically how you would be able to implement that. And then the last thing I'd add is that, we remember we kind of set this up, discussed kind of there's three steps. This technical report, which we were calling a technical memorandum in our earlier meetings, kind of lays out a framework and an understanding for what steps need to be taken to get a full demand management program in place. The next step would be to develop a work plan to actually put that together. So if you scroll down, Stephanie, to like page 5 on that document, just right at the bottom of page 5. I'm sorry, top of that page. There you go, bottom of 5. So if you go right between page 5 and 6, just scroll down there. So this document is the framework, right? Kind of lays out the skeleton. Again, this executive summary in the first 9 pages gives you the snapshot that you're looking for, plus some additional details. Next step is typically putting together a work plan where you flesh out some of the details that are laid out in the framework and actually figure out how some of these program components would work. And then the final step is implementing, you know, and that's the typical sequence where then you actually stand up and get a program component that's implemented and approved and start measuring water savings. So that's all I wanted to add. And yeah, I'm obviously happy to answer any questions. And, you know, or David's engineering or LSE folks, Jeff and Eddie could as well in future meetings. Oh, and I guess the last thing to point out is that like we're still working on this internally and getting some internal edits, and so you know, this is a bit of a living document, and we'll get modified based on other team members' input.
Duncan, just to follow up on that, is it, I mean, small revisions, is it a few bit of updates? What, can you give a quick idea of what the revisions are?
I think it'll be most. I don't think you'll see huge changes to it. It'll be a lot of like language cleanup and kind of minor to moderate changes. You know, in particular, LSC and DE want to make sure that we're careful in the language that we're using for accounting for groundwater savings and you know what we call net pumping versus gross pumping and those types of the words. So it's really it'll just be kind of a cleanup for consistency throughout the document. I don't think it changes the, I don't expect it to change the flow or conclusions or, you know, the components that are in it.
So not really substance, but the more language, bear in mind those types of edits.
Yeah.
All right. With that, I'll turn it over to the working group members. Any clarifying questions for Duncan or Justin?
I think this is Michael Ward. I think the question I have is where whether we're going to see the work plan or not, and if so, what's the timing for that?
Justin, do you have thoughts on?
Yeah, I mean that has a lot to do with whether or not all of the involved entities decide to spend the money to create the work plan, right? And so that's a monetary decision that's going to be made. Ultimately, that's not just this group that does that. So I think there's a few more steps to determine whether or not like a full-blown work plan is the outcome of this. And that'll be sort of a discussion of, you know, between all of the groups, including you guys, right? Of this idea of where do we want to expend our funds and how far do we want to develop this through consultants.
And I guess along those lines, I'm just wondering, you know, what kind of, if we have time, you know, what's the time requirements for development of that work? And, you know, if we have time under this grant to pull that off.
So, you know, I've been talking a lot with, you know, Eddie and, you know, via Eddie with this team. You know, I think that ultimately what we have to bring in front of the board does not fit the timeline parameter of this as a work plan, right? So we're going to have to bring something up to our board of directors for the Flood Control and Water Conservation District that does not have a work plan created by a consultant associated with it. That being said, ultimately, what we are bringing in front of the board has this big layer of flexibility in this 5-year bill set in it, right? That's going to have some work that has to be done within those 5-year programs, a 5-year parameter, that something like this might affect. Does that make sense? So that's sort of that what we're going to have to deal with in the middle, you know, determining whether or not we want to have someone give us more input during that 5-year period, if we want to use the data that we have and have those discussions. There's a lot in that. And by the way, it's not cheap, so that's going to have to be part of that discussion.
Yeah, okay. Because I have one more.
Yeah.
So if we can, so at least. What I think is happening is we'll get this technical memorandum completed by January, but we still have until April as far as the grant is concerned. You know, if we can be moving in during this in the spring on the work plan to make that pull that together.
As long as there are funds available within the grant to
okay.
give to it. I don't know what I can't even quote off the top of my head what's within coin left to do that. So that was part of that conversation.
Well, I was going to ask Duncan, what's the minimum requirement that we need to do to meet DWR requirement?
I mean, I think that's also it's a question not just for me but for everybody. So, I mean, the short answer is there is no, DWR, as we've talked about, doesn't specifically tell you what demand management is. It's just a thing that needs to be put together. And I think the realization when I look across the GSAs that are working on this and where we're working and in other areas where we're not working, the process that we're following here is what everybody else is following, right? It's no different. Setting up a demand management program is no different than, a new water supply project. It takes time to plan, both technically and politically. It takes time to set up an administrative framework to run the program, a measurement framework so you can ensure it's getting savings, and a thoughtful way to fund and implement the program. And so to me, what I've seen in other GSAs is putting together the work plan and starting to implement it is, are the reasonable steps that you can take. And that should be sufficient for DWR or anybody reviewing this. But I know that there's also a lot of interest in getting this stuff done and getting actions that are resulting in measurable savings. So I think the short answer is you're on the path that I'm seeing everybody else on. There's a handful of sub-basins that are a few steps ahead just because they immediately started with fallowing programs pretty much after or during GSP implementation. But aside from that, everybody else is putting together, a work plan or working on implementing components of the work plan and standing up measurement systems to be able to measure groundwater savings.
So basically, an outline of a framework and a work plan.
I'm sorry, I didn't pick up that last part.
An outline of the framework and the work plan.
I think putting together, like having the actual work plan together, would be good to do. Like that, I think getting to this next step is where you should be. That's where you have a program that says this is what we're going to do, and then you start doing it. So I think getting to step two in this three-step process that we've laid out feels like where I would want to be bringing this back to DWR or others that says, hey, we're actually doing this and we're implementing it.
Thanks, Duncan. Thanks, Hal. Justin, anything you want to add to?
Yeah, I think that's very much the draft that we're on right now. Ultimately, what will be brought to the board has this this last bit that needs to happen, and that's what the 5 years is for, right? To make those sort of finite details within how the consequences come into play. Because ultimately, if you say that we are going to enact a restriction, right, at a baseline based on using an MD, that's one thing. But all of the things that happen up to that to prevent it within demand management is another. And we are saying you're going to get a long way from your MOs, right? You're going to slowly implement actions as you get farther and farther away from your objective. How those actions come into play and what they happen is going to have to be further detailed over time, right? How do we expend those funds per se that are built by a program like this in order to generate the savings that we need? How do we confirm them? And what are we going to do to make sure that the money is spent in a way that gets us back what we need, which is the savings in our water?
Other questions for Justin and for Duncan?
I have one.
Go ahead, Ian.
It's Ian. So allocation, jumping to allocations, why was allocation trading within an SY area not considered?
Justin, I can...
At least from the standpoint, pros and cons.
What's your big question? I'm sorry.
I say, looking at, all right, down the road to allocations and Fallow Bank, land repurposing, and so forth, why was trading allocations within an SY area?
Yeah, I saw it was mentioned.
It's kind of, but not really.
Yeah.
I mean, it's alluded to in some ways, not trading specifically, but some of the impacts from some of the different fallow bank and land repurposing, but it's not addressed head on.
It needs to be a line item.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree.
You know, what, you know, pros and cons. You know, if you've already defined that you have a certain sustainable yield within a cluster of polygons, which, as I stated, I'm somewhat skeptical of the numbers and calculations there. But let's assume that that's the case. Then what would be the disadvantage, if there is one, over some of these other programs to being able to trade your allocation?
The only thing is John brought up, I would love to see that develop in this pie. The only issue I've had is the localized impact it can create. That was alluded to in DOT, but it didn't elaborate on it at all.
But I mean, these can create the same localized issues.
Yeah.
So we'll talk a little bit about that when we get into this next segment of these presentations. We can talk about it so we can have some discussion specifically.
But maybe he can answer.
Sorry. Yeah. It's fun when you're remote. You can't pick up the cues in the room. So
dancing, don't worry.
So, Stephanie, if you scroll down to like page 48 on the document, so there are a couple of things. Just first, the way this framework is set up is based on the discussions that we've had. There's a desire to focus on incentive-driven program components first, and then work on some of what we might call more mandatory or strict approaches in parallel. One of those would be an allocation. So I would put things like land repurposing or a fallow bank under the incentive-driven approaches. There's a lot of grant funding out there right now. There's DOC funding. There was DWR funding. There's more money under Prop 4 for those programs. You don't have to have an allocation in place for a program like that to work. They can be targeted spatially, which is something that's important, really everywhere, and maybe in particular in the Tehama County subbasins, for the reasons that we've discussed at other meetings. And I think that's why this polygon concept has considered to come up. And then, as you all have discussed and we've discussed, there's, issues. And I think Justin's going to talk through some of these with kind of the practical way a polygon approach could work. How you're defining a polygon and what sustainable yield actually looks like. So within that, if put all those issues on the side for a second. If you're thinking about an allocation system, there is a discussion of flexibility for an allocation, which would include, trading. And that is described in this document. So if on page 48, where Stephanie is here, if you start there, it kind of goes through considerations for like time dimensions, so like, can things be carried over? Do you have to use it all within 1 year? Is it 5 years? An example of some of the groundwater management districts in Kansas have a 5 year rolling average that they're managing for. So you have a very long time dimension to allow flexibility from year to year. And then I think the questions that I heard the working group discussing now are, if you keep scrolling down, Stephanie, under spatial dimensions of an allocation, how are those set up, right? Can you move an allocation between parcels, let's say within a polygon or even across polygons? And there's examples of being able to do both of those things to increase flexibility. And then I think as a way of a practical example, and I think we discussed this in the first meeting that I came up to, the Madera County GSA set up its allocation system with this concept of a farm unit. There's no polygons. It's just done at the GSA scale. And then within that, the allocation is being managed at a farm unit, which is a non-contiguous grouping of parcels that are under common ownership. So they're tracking total pumping across all of those parcels, not on a parcel by parcel or field by field basis. And so that's kind of an example of like an informal market or trading approach, right? You just allow people to group lands together in different ways and effectively move water between parcels. Another way that could work is that you just allow for that to happen, to actually move water between landowners that are parcels that are not under the common ownership.
Yeah, and that is what I didn't see explicitly said. So yeah, I think a line item.
Yeah.
In order first.
So how about let's flag it as we work through the through Justin's part when he would be with Lycon, so let's flag it and move back.
A couple other quick.
Yeah, go ahead.
More like housekeeping. Page 14, the data. Well, registration, sure, but there's also many multi-complete monitoring wells installed. Reporting. What was it? 5, 6.
And also in Ambo. And
just for completeness
and Red Bluff. Yeah.
So for completeness. And then any acreage based fees would require a Prop 218, correct?
No. There's two ways within the law that you can associate fees. One of them is a 218 like rule. It actually doesn't say 218, it just says 13D. And then the other methodology is a direct regulatory fee, which just requires a vote of the board. Those are the two methodologies which you do fees.
Yeah, with a direct regulatory fee, you have to actually be able to show that the charge directly correlates to some expenditure.
And an action. That's correct. Yeah, and that depends on how you relate them. And by the way, there are most definitely agencies putting in place per acre fees to fund all this work under that Prop 26 style fee. It does exist in many places within California.
I have no doubt that people are trying.
So I'm just telling you, yeah, it exists both ways. Yeah. In fact, just right here in the Bina, they did that. That's not a 218 process.
You call that a Prop 26
style? About Prop 26
that's
style.
The direct regulatory fees, what you're referring to is Prop 26 style.
So we are a regulatory agency. We are doing a regulatory action, and we are charging you to do that. So now, they did not do a 218 vote.
I understand how it works.
Yeah.
I just would indicate that, like, Corning Subbasin GSA, they actually did Prop 218 for their fees, and they were successful. So it's not out of the realm of possibility.
Just to be clear, they were sued and settled. So successful was maybe a variation.
Are the fees still in place?
Some of them are.
Which are not?
A portion of the fee was modified down to the 218 because of the settlement. I hadn't heard that. That is what occurred, by the way. They did settle, and a portion of that fee was changed because of that.
I'll take you at your word, Justin, but I haven't heard that, and I don't know, you know how much and why. And like, all I know is that people are still being charged fees.
They are.
Significant fees, and they were voted, they did vote on it and passed.
That's true.
My whole point is it's not a realm of possibility. It's an actual vote.
I agree.
And Justin, you did a presentation to the commission last week, right, related to funding and how, like, the schedule of when some of, like, information is going to be considered. So, like, informing the direction of whether or not, like, say, the 218, 26 process.
So on a monthly basis, I'm going to be bringing new fee related items forward to the commission and then the board, of course, after discussion at the commission level, that are, you know, sort of break it down into pieces. How much money do we have to have, right, in order to run these programs? And we will discuss and work through that process. How much of, say, a chargeable item, say, for example, like volume of water, is used, and what ultimately that would look like to be divided across that volume. Right. So you can kind of get a scale of what these fees would look like and how they would be when we have those discussions. So it's broken into how much money do you need? What, how much of each of the volumes there are, acres, water, whatever they are, and then what that looks like when you divide it across that as an assumption point, broken into those pieces, right? Because ultimately, without those data, it's really difficult to look at something and see what the cost would be in each of these varied scenarios. So, and then ultimately out of that, there's going to have to be a decision about which one we're going to take and how we're going to move forward and which process we're going to do, which would include a 218 mic process or a 26 mic process as we move through it. So, and by the way, it could be portions of both, right? Mm-hmm. Certain activities you do might be 26 mic, certain activities you do might be 218 mic. So I can't vote one way or the other which way it's going to go at this point.
We are a little bit past the top of the hour, but any other clarifying questions on the technical report or Duncan or Justin?
The only thing I think it's too much to ask this in a call, no random. Yeah, every now and then, you know, we're trying, it's mentioned that we're trying to withstand legal challenges. And I don't expect that to be defined in this TM, but it'd be nice if Duncan, if you could give us references or give us some, you know, rabbit trails to go down and learn about that. So we become a little bit more informed as to what those challenges will apply. There could be.
So just as a little side note to that, we have already secured independent counsel to review processes and give us the legal challenges that have happened already and the risks associated with those methodologies. So you are going to get to see that as a presentation of someone who is an independent legal authority that does that for a living. Hopefully that will help as we move through this. So you'll get write-ups about this process has been challenged in this way. Here are the options you can do to make it happen. Here are the options, the risks associated with those options, et cetera. So we did that on purpose so that we could get that sort of independent input to help us make those decisions.
Michael, how about for the technical report that since it looks like Duncan and Jeff working in so many different groundwater basins, if they're aware of kind of legal challenges or things that would relate that can be able to flag it for, like Justin, to be able to share with the other consultants so that way we're at least tracking it and trying to learn from others. Okay. All right. So in terms of next steps, again, that as Duncan mentioned, there's going to be some like language cleanups with the document, but nothing particularly substantive. So the content and the substantive thesis of this technical report is here. Encourage folks, you know, email Justin and me if you have questions or comments, as we whatever you send and get it compiled. So we are tracking when you are sending us stuff.
Are you looking for any feedback at this point on some of the technical aspects on this? It might need revision.
If you want to email,
I can. This one catches my interest in what you've got on the screen right now. So on those recharge projects, I think it needs to give the range of potential recharge. Mm-hmm. I think what you've got there, you've got 535 acre feet of recharge potential in Revlon. That's only assuming under this temporary water right where you only pump during high water events, which is extremely limited. Those have significantly more potential than 535 of those six sites. So this is painting a picture of a extremely bleak, unrealistic picture to somebody that's not familiar with what's going on the situation. So I grant you the 535 is based on those creeks might only have 2 days a year during this temporary white right phase that you can pump any water on, but the goal is to convert those into permanent rights that have significantly more recharge. So I think that needs to be clarified in this document right there.
Thanks, Hassel.
Stephanie and Justin, just from my end, I think those types of comments and feedback are good and things that we can address. I mean, this, like the table that we've got up here is just a you know, a summary from the GSPs. So if there's stuff that folks see that we need to edit, now's the time to get those comments to us.
I think it would be good, by the way, to wait to make that modification until we get the input back from the blog folks. You know what I mean? So you kind of give that range.
Yeah, but yeah, I just know if in the time frame that we're having, that's going to be pinned down. All that's asked is saying is the range.
Hopefully, the answer is yes. But yes, you're like, we need
to. No, but I mean, that either way, you're also going to notice is the probability of getting that temporary water right. But we've got to work on the conversion of that. This is painting a extremely bleak outlook. And it also, it's only addressed in the grant funded ones. So that needs to be stated as well.
Yeah, that's probably a good clarification.
Because you don't recharge there, is what you're saying. That's not realistic.
Yes.
No recharge. Yes. So you're within this room, people may agree or disagree, that's fine, but you're painting a picture that a reader of this, a stakeholder that reads this, is painting a not a reasonable picture. It needs to be changed.
So you're saying just put the upper end range in there, beside the bottom, that's the worst case scenario, and put the upper range in there.
Yeah. And also that those what there's what's grant funded, right?
Right.
This is the short term, and that grant funding is going to be gone. There's going to be other work that has to take place. You don't need to list them because you don't necessarily have them. But you got to mention that's got to be a mention on a recharge consideration.
So specific to table two, the request is clarifying language one, the fact that it captures the estimate of grant related to grant funded.
And temporary water, right? Is the conditions upon which those small numbers are there, which is extremely restrictive on diversion. The end run on a temporary water, right, is basically to pilot test something and gives you the ability to pull some water to test and see what you can recharge. And obviously the mission on that is then to convert beneficial projects into a permanent water right, which are less restrictive, that ideally you can pump throughout the winter or recharge throughout the winter, not 2 days in the winter.
All right, that's one kind of a footnote. So, marking that, if you can get the comments, because it sounds like that was one particular one that caught your eye. How the if there are others, again, to this whole group, is it a reasonable, and Duncan, check me on this, if this is a decent time frame, folks, if you can email Justin and me your comments a week from today, does that work for folks? And Duncan, does that work for purposes of what you're doing?
Yeah, I mean, that'd be awesome. I think that the question is really for the working group, if that's sufficient time.
That works for folks, then that gives a bit of time for the technical consultants to read through, and also gives some time before the August 6th CSTAB meeting. So again, like being able to pull in the questions and comments that you have, keeping the discussion going and kind of holding in the corny side of it.
Tied in with that, and it may be in here, but in my time I had to review this, didn't see it. The quantifying the potential in lieu acre foot benefit, is that documented in here and spelled out for clarification of overview of the severity of the problem and the potential resolutions?
There's not detail on that or any quantification, particularly on the project side. I mean, really what you have in there is the table that's up on the screen. And the rest of this is just laying out demand management items.
Wouldn't it be critical to have that as a component on the potential of in-lieu benefit? When you say overdraft number, then we should be stating also the real potentials out there for solutions that work. The goal would be to put in place to reduce the overdraft number or the impacts of the demand management plan.
Yeah.
Eddie has a direct table on that. You can just get it, brother.
I know there's 15,000 acre feet of in lieu that's in the process of available in the Corning subbasin. That's half of the overdraft number. So it would seem to me in a demand management plan, that's critical that it's stated what has existing surface water rights that that can be more fully used to offset, right? That gives you a better, clearer picture of a scope of the problem that you're trying to solve with demand management.
So flagging in that as an additional thing, we might be able to loop back with Eddie to see what information that he has. Right, so I'm going to push us forward because just have a lot of hydrographs and data for us to walk through. But Duncan, thank you so much for joining us. I know that you're either on or getting on the road, so appreciate you calling in, and then we'll be in touch.
Okay. Thanks, Stephanie. And I'm on for a bit. I'll just hang on and listen, and then I will need to drop off a little bit before 10 to get on the road.
I've got a question. If Don can believe in that, might be a little off topic. Are we dealing anything with polygons today?
Yeah, you're going to see some polygon stuff today.
Okay. Because I have a question potentially for Duncan on that. I don't know if he's still going to be online. That I don't know if we want to go there now. It's your call.
Well, either way, we'll make sure that we flag it and let him know if he's not online. He has to jump off of it. Let's make sure that we will at least flag it. Okay, so Justin, turning it over to you. And this is where you wanted the...
Yeah. Right? So the first thing, if you...
It's way too tiny for me to read. All right. So
the first thing if you bring it up is the Excel spreadsheet.
You named the data.
This is the data. So as opposed to having a monster spreadsheet like we reviewed, if you recall, about how all of the calculations come about for things like, say, yield. This is the actual parts that go into the calculation and some of the peripheral data so that we can sort of get a feeling for where things are going, if that makes sense. So first of all, this is broken into for the Red Bluff sub-basin. This is broken into the three, what would currently be sustainable yield zones, right? So the average safe yield creates the sustainable yield within a zone that you saw written down on that chart on the first meeting. Those three zones. So RV1 is one of those. RV2, 3, 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9 is another one of those. And RV4, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15 is the third one of those. So if you remember, the city of Red Bluff essentially is RV1. The section associated with 2, 3, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 is sort of right in the middle. Goes from Rancho Bahama up to the river just south of the city of Red Bluff in a swath. And then there's a small grouping in the lower eastern corner, yeah, that is along the river, roughly bordered by I-5 and the river. Right? It does go past it in some locations, I-5 that is. So this is that grouping of those data within those breaks. To be clear, that will not, in 5 years when this happens, that will not necessarily be the breakouts, because it will be based on the calculation at that time. And so this is just a representation of what it could look like based on the data that we have now.
Go ahead. So looking at the first group, the RV2 through RV9, you see that safe yield of 8.8, and it seems that you're trying to group similar polys, and then that particular polygon, you would just throw out a kind of consideration and then group the rest. But see, I mean, from a legal standpoint, you have to group by similarity, but what you base that on, I'm not sure.
Yeah, so we're talking There's two, we're talking, when you look at the blue, the hues within this map, right? You're talking about total available volume to extract within the polygon. Not the same yield calculation.
But yeah, there's a grouping. The grouping has to be based on something.
It is based on total available volume to extract from the polygon.
To me, odd. You say that I need to. What I'm looking for is comparable numbers, not
and,
something.
That's and that is
a comparable. You're saying total. So you're looking at 700.
That's right. So if you look, there's a range for each one of these. If you actually look at this chart, this one is 1 to 5,000, less than 1,000. 5,000 to 15,000, right? And those are the available total water, because when you use safe yield within that calculation, that is dependent on how much water is actually pulled out of the basin in that given moment, and that is right now extremely variable because we don't have a restricted total volume that keeps extraction to a specific amount. So anybody can literally go put a well in and extract any amount that they want to within any polygon at any time, and that calculation would immediately change. This is just about how much water is available to use as opposed to how much water is used. When you get later on, when we start talking about the safe yield portion, that is safe yield per irrigated acre. And that's when you start to take in, right, this volume allowance. And that changes every time the map changes on how many irrigated acres there are. That's what the scenario is. That's sort of why you're seeing it the way that it is. So they are similar in the sense that that's how they have similar availability of pumping, not similar current pumping, because the similar current pumping has a huge variable within it. If you use that as your primary mode, it has way too much variability within it. You should be using one that's relatively stable in comparison, like how much of water is available on average. By the way, does that make sense?
Yeah, I don't know. I certainly get the logic. I'm just trying to. If I were to have a demand management program, I would be looking at RBA differently instead of if water is available.
You wouldn't per se, right? In that the reason why that so the whole reason why we are doing this and breaking this up into these smaller parts and managing it this way is that you can get localized, you can take into account localized effects, but also average those localized effects across larger areas. Right? Because what you don't want to do is have one individual well that has a localized effect create a problem for the entire basin. And so this takes that out of the mix. And you want this bit of variability within your same yield to play into that average mathematics so that it has less chance of having an immediate effect in just one area. So you're using this law of averages to brace that effect, to slow the possibility of action for over time.
Stephanie, can you put that spreadsheet there, please?
Yeah. So what we're looking at here is groupings of polygons with similar average total acre foot of yield. Not per acre yield. And when you look at that 8.8, you're talking about the current multiplied per irrigated acre. And those are two entirely different things. Ultimately, as those change over time, more or less, you will gain more save yield or less save yield, depending on development or retraction. And so over time, they will also bunch differently in 5-year periods. So it is not permanent that 2, 3, 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9 are in the same group.
right? Every 5 years, when this is re-looked at or re-justified, that map then re-correlates what's together. Because you will be changing that, your actions will be changing the attribute of each individual polygon over time. And then they will become more like other polygons. Does this make some sense? And so that keeps you continuously using like polygons together to create action within those areas. Hopefully I'm saying that clear enough.
State that again.
So you will continuously be updating what the like polygons are to create actions that are similar within those areas of like polygons. So over time, this map that you see here will change. Every 5 years, you'll be looking at this, and maybe it's this, and this, and this, and this, or this, and this, depending on how the water gets managed within those areas, right? Because of the ultimately how much water is available. And also, by the way, when we get more data. So because, you, say, for example, here, right, we are using a well that's right there, right? But we've added 3 wells to this area to use as an RMS well in the future, right? I'm just using it as an example. I'm not saying we have.
In your angle.
Yeah. So there's one well right here, right, that we're using as a representation of this polygon, right? Over time, as we increase the amount of data that we have, you will increase the number of polygons, and those lists may not even be exactly the same, but they will still be bunched together by like that. So it allows that ultimate flexibility to continuously change this on 5-year cycles to create and continue to update what is a polygon with a like attribute.
And contiguous or not?
It doesn't have to be contiguous because it's solely based on whether or not it's a like attribute. You'll see, if you look over here, you can kind of see this a little bit within, say, Las Molinas, right? You have some darker and darker and lighter, right, shades here. That means that these would be like, this would be on its own, and that would be like. In the current program, it's how the data looks right now. But as that modifies over time, that will change. Because the thing that I hear from you guys, and I actually really, really agree with, is that you need to be able to adjust your response based on the conditions that occur. If you just put a flatline response in place, then it creates problems because you're regulating stuff that doesn't need to be regulated.
In theory, yeah, it makes sense to adjust, as you're saying, but how's that actually going to get done?
So it's built into the program that every 5 years it gets readjusted. So there's a reallocation.
How are you going to reallocate and be able to sustain challenges to that?
Explain to me what you mean by sustain.
How are you going to come up with these so-called areas that have different...
The map is always the same. So if it falls within this usable water range, it gets bunched together.
Okay, how are you going to define and redefine continually the usable water range?
The usable water range is the salt state that's continuous. It's always 1,000, 5,000, 5,000, 15,000, less than 1,000.
I'm talking about the area on the map.
How are
you're talking about continually modifying these boundaries that within that Red Bluff subbasin would have different allocation?
Would have over, so I guess, how should I best define this? Every 5-year period, the groupings that get treated in a specific way and lead to the averages put together to create a safe yield. So how's the best way to say this? Sorry, I don't want it to be confusing. If you look at the way that the safe yield is calculated in our drawings, right? You're talking about it multiplying a change in the amount of storage, right? These groundwater levels by a mathematical number, a coefficient of how fast water moves within that area, right? And then multiply it by the acreage to give you the total volume of water within that area that is a safe yield, not a sustainable yield, a safe yield. And it's important to have a distinction in those two terms. A safe yield is calculated by change in groundwater level multiplied by that. See that red highlighted SY? That is from the model that states how fast water moves through in that area. That's a super simplified sort of description of it, but it's like the perk rate of water within that area. And then multiply the acreage. That gives you the total volume of usable water that is safe.
Within that polygon.
Within that polygon.
That's
and so a challenge. It's the data that we have right now, right? Ultimately, it used to be that these polygons were much bigger and it was over a way bigger mathematical area and created some inconsistency issues that would create regulation that affects somebody terribly in one spot or another, right? This allows you to average all of those safe yields from each one of these similar smaller polygons to create one number that is your sustainable yield for that entire area.
So the challenge that's going to take place on that is whether or not those polygons are similar within themselves or across an arbitrary.
It's a fixed number. So the polygons themselves, even have the possibility of changing over time. That's the flexibility that's built into the system. As we get more and more data, more and more RMS wells, set more and more MOs and MTs for more and more locations, it makes this more and more defined, right? Right now, we are creating an action based on the data that we have. It's the data that we have. And ultimately,
and the model.
What's that?
And the model.
And the model. Always. The model is going to be built in
the model. That's right.
The only thing in the model that's driving it is that SY number.
Yeah.
And all that is a factor associated with, for lack of a broad and huge in-depth discussion on SY, the water movement, the speed of the water movement within that area.
The boundaries aren't determined, have not been determined though, based on what the model says similarities.
The boundaries are determined based on its distance from the RMS.
I understand. But the fact that it's not necessarily, you could have the two adjacent polygons based on an RMS well with different allocations they're given.
You can have the choice.
It'll be challenged every time that it's an arbitrary polygon based on RMS well that's not actuality.
Actually, I will tell you this. Broken up areas of basins have definitely sustained and gone through the court system and held. And so that means that you can break areas into smaller spaces legally, right, as it sits right now, and define them in a specific way. So I don't think, I know what you're saying, that people are going to be like, well, I'm just on this side of the border of this, and I'm on this side of the border of this. That exists regardless of where you
live.
That exists, like, from here to here. This is Corning, this is Red Bluff.
Duncan, do you see any issues with that on why maybe it wouldn't be model-based rather than the boundaries that we have?
Yeah, I understand the question that you're raising, and I think it's an important one. And I think it's one we discussed at some of these earlier committee meetings and there is some discussion of this in the framework document that we put together, you know, spatial considerations for allocation design. And, you know, that's been handled a few different ways in different areas. If you have an allocation that's the same across the subbasin, then there's differential rules about how that allocation can move within the subbasin. And then what we're talking about here is different. It's having a different allocation for different spatial areas. I have this, you know, I think I've raised the same question about the proximity to RMS wells. This concept that Justin's walking through is a little bit different in that you're grouping polygons, but those polygon boundaries are still defined by the RMS wells. So I think what you're raising is like, well, what if an RMS well changes, the location of it changes, you know, you add one or subtract one, how does that affect these boundaries? And then a parcel that was previously in one area is now in another? And is there a good nexus to groundwater conditions? Because that's what you ultimately need to have this stand up. So I think you're raising good questions that are important for this type of program design. And I think that's what sounds like that's what Justin's working through with this concept of grouping. And the question is, how do these tie back to some of the groundwater conditions? I think that last question is important and probably is something that, like, you know, Eddie and the LSCE team or Jeff and the DE team should also be weighing in on.
Is Eddie online?
No, Eddie.
So I'm going to need to convey that to Eddie, because I think to be able to withstand the challenges, it's got to be the areas need to be defined rather than these polygons. They need to be defined by a hydrological model, not by proximity to an RMS well, because otherwise I don't see how that's would withstand a challenge. There's no way.
It does.
Especially,
you're talking about it being fluid, even that size and shape and location and boundaries is so change, as you're saying, in the next.
I would put it to the race,
but I certainly do the whole model.
You know? I'm just going to
four things is being decent polygons, correct? Based around the
so we changed. They are now. We changed them to decent on purpose because we all agreed that
but
not having them decent would have its own problems, right? Where they're defined by something arbitrary. Now they are defined from their about their distance from
FS. Okay.
Yes. And so that is.
But then that doesn't accurately reflect the hydrology under them.
There is no way to accurately
the hydrology under them. Wouldn't it be via modeling? If modeling would determine the similar groundwater conditions, then that would be your area.
I have
that would withstand a challenge.
I
you see what I'm saying?
I know exactly what you're saying. I just don't think we get there at this point because
what's the model? LSC's working on modeling. What Duncan, are you familiar with what they're working on for the hydrological model that's due out as part of this plan? The what's it called? The Tehama County Integrated Hydrologic Model, the IHN.
I'm not familiar with the details of that.
What do you want to know about?
Oh, I don't know what it is, but it's a hydrological model, and I'm assuming that might be a better source of how to determine these areas.
Yeah.
That have
statewide hydrological models. It's a broad model that says within this subbasin, here are the conditions. Here's how much water comes in. Here's how much water comes out. Here's where those waters tend to flow. Here's how much water is used. Here's how much water goes in by rainfall. Here's how much water is allocated to surface water. Though all of those inputs into the model give generalized conditions associated with the entirety of the basin. And so you can use the model, but ultimately what that means is that you're going to set allocations associated with the basin. And that is problematic in itself.
Can we get
which we agree?
I think it'd be appropriate if we get Eddie's feedback on that concept for this.
I absolutely
maybe I'm the only one that has that concern.
Yeah, I just don't. You can, I think you have not made the model.
I don't know what the model output is yet, right? So I don't know what the numbers are. The concept though, the light similar groundwater conditions that are going to get allocated is a lot less challengeable than. Then
I don't
proximity to a monitor well in a property that has two parcels or in two different.
No, I understand the concern. All over. I just don't see a way of getting. I don't, at this point, I don't see a way with any accuracy. I mean, if you're worried about a challenge, you know, with any accuracy, I don't see a way of understanding the hydrologic condition. I've pointed out numerous times what we're doing. Is not related to the actual hydrologic
condition. No, I know you have. How about, wouldn't it make sense if we got Eddie's input on that?
I just think, you know, most models, they rely on a large enough area so you can kind of average the differences. And I think that's what we're seeing here. I don't think you can get it down to that.
I get conceptually Eddie's feedback on whether or not he would have similar concerns is what I'm bringing up. And if they're
something we need to consider. That's all I'm asking. I'm not proposing a solution.
I don't disagree.
But the expert give us some feedback.
I don't disagree with what you're saying as far as the concerns.
I agree.
All right, I've captured it as an information request out of Eddie to better understand what it takes to incorporate the hydrological conditions. I know this group and the commission had agreed to go with Ephesian. I have no idea if I'm saying that right anymore. Polygon method because it was the distance from the RMS wells, and that was kind of the best that we could do for now.
Yeah, just a quick response to this. A challenge to any sustainable use, any pumpable matter is an adjudication of water. And anybody can do that at any time.
Yeah,
right. Like, hey, I want to adjudicate this because I don't agree. Right? And then it goes to a court system, and the court goes through some process that's probably similar to this and determines how much water you can use.
Yeah,
that can happen anytime, literally,
or anything. What I'm talking about though is trying to make sure that we're not that we're using the most reasonable approach that has the best chance to stand up against that.
And Hal, I think part of that, and some of my comments that I emailed, I think reflected is we need to be reasonable on a restriction approach, so that you enable maximum flexibility, and you're just going to have to. I think that's important because what'll end up happening if you're too rigid, like some of the stuff I tried to point out in that email, is you're just going to be asking for somebody to challenge.
Right.
So I think there needs to be some common sense applied there. And I think, is it a risk? Yeah, it's a risk. But I don't, you know, I'm no expert on the hydrological model. I have dealt with models in a lot of different situations. And, you know, they're when you get down so far, as far as trying to pinpoint exactly what's going on, they generally rely on an averaging of a larger area. They have to, because you'll never have the information you need. You know, you keep drilling test wells every sub-basin to actually kind of
thousands
of them, and that will only still be kind of an indication. Don't disagree with you. Actually have brought this up back when we were doing the whole, you know, should we go Thiessen or should we go another way? But I don't know. I think that if we stay reasonable on how restrictions are implemented, giving the growers and everyone else maximum flexibility.
So if you can get maximum flexibility, then your proposal would be to stick with the polygon approach that we have?
I think the polygon approach at this point in time is the only thing that is that is reasonable. Is any better?
Would you be willing to see, would you be entertaining that same discussion question with Eddie present?
Sure. Yeah. And by the way, I've had it with Eddie many times.
You know, sure. And it's like, okay, well, we don't know anything about really what's going on, or we know very little about what's going on under the ground for real.
Todd, it looked like you wanted to jump in.
Sure. No, it's done fish stuff.
But, you know, we don't know for sure.
Yeah.
And we have a bunch of monitoring wells, maybe not everything that we want. And so, you know, it's reasonable in my mind, you know, basically what is a decent polygon? You got a monitoring well, and you got another monitoring well, and another one, and that the borders are equidistant from those monitoring wells. I mean, that's
how else are you going to say that's the best you got?
And that's what Eddie's going to tell you about. I've had many of these conversations with
but, you know,
and it's cool. That, well, I'm happy to say it, but
I'm just going to hear him say it because there's some other avenues right on intricacies that I think he'll bring up that would enlighten all of us.
One thing that it does by using the polygons, it gives us the actual data from the hydrographs. We can tell what that well is actually doing as opposed to a model which is going to blend it all in and smooth out the edges and make it look pretty. But at least this way we know exactly what the readings were in that well at a given point in time.
I think that grouping them and trying to come up with some like grouping is a solid approach. I think the last comments I had on that was we need to group them, whatever way you group them, that the individual adjacent polygons are too small to actually make the effects go like this.
Yeah,
it needs to be buffered.
All right, I'm glad you noticed that I built
maybe one polygon that's is way too big. There's so much variation in that polygon.
On the west side. You're talking about on the west side?
On my property.
No doubt.
If you monitor them only within 1,000 feet east of where it is, I think it'd be an entirely different situation.
Could very well be.
And if you have a base allocation over the boundary, unless you're all that polygon is way off.
All right, I'm gonna do a time check because we have about like 15 minutes on this model to double check this. Just I know
that Boxley just address is a date on it because I think it might also help this. So go ahead and bring up the RB2 one slide. Yeah, sorry. I'm not trying to steal your stuff. All right, so this is RB2. All right, so this is in that large area, sort of in the middle section there. This is our hydrograph. You can see our MO under empty.
Can you show us real quick which polygon that is?
RB2 is, I'll just describe it to you right now. Yeah.
It's right here.
It's right there. It's a small one.
Where is that on that? Okay, that is
south of the city of Red. It's right. It actually goes through the city of Red Bluff, kind of.
And down to the river?
And down to the river from, you know, just around I-5-ish. Up to the river there and up. Exactly, up towards 36 there, where the river comes around.
Okay.
So opposite side of the bend.
Where's the well?
The well is right. It's hard to see. It's right there.
Where's that from the diversion dam?
It is
the well.
Not very far from the diversion dam, in fact. RB2.
So around Altuve and in that area.
So it's around, let me think about this just really quickly, spatially. It is just south of the city of Red Bluff, not very far from the river. So it's just south of, it's like, think about like DC area. Does that make sense? In that sort of general area. Yeah. All right, so here's the detail. Go ahead and let's show the detail there. So you can see the long term. Here's the detail with how this would work. So you can see during the bad years that it goes below the MO, but generally speaking, it runs above. As an average, the spring to fall is around a 10-foot amplitude. By the way, these numbers will give the actual averages when we do this, right? The real average feet, but it's approximately 10 feet. That means that step one begins at 2 feet below the MO. Step two begins at 4 feet below the MO. Step three begins at 8 feet below the MO. And step four at 10 feet below the MO, meaning the entirety of the range is below the MO. That 10-foot amplitude.
I forgot what your steps mean.
We'll talk about that. But all of that is just an increase in the fee by a percentage on the percentage of the pumped water. So this is not an actual restriction that says you cannot pump water.
This is just required.
We are going to take more money from those areas that are having this problem, and we are going to use that money to fix that area in that specific problem associated with a drop in that groundwater. So, yep. So step one. 50% or more, right? So this, I'm saying that's trigger step one, but 50% or more of the total RMS wells within this area, right? So there's eight of them. You have to have four or more of them go to the step one condition before step one takes place for the area. See what I'm saying? That's that average.
Did you see that?
In this area, right? Let's say there's eight representative monitoring sites within this area. At least half of them, so four of them or more, have to reach the step one level in order for the step one action to take place. You go back to that detail one more time? No, not that one. I'm sorry, the actual detail hydrograph of the hydrograph. So in this area, right now, there are no steps currently in place, meaning it does not meet the requirement of step one now. All right. Let's go to the next one, which is, I think, three. RB3. All right. There's the hydrograph, RB3. All right. As you can see, this is one of those ones that pops down below your MT, and this is also one that has a squish MO to MT duration. We go down to the detail for RB3. I snapshot these close so we can just kind of look at where we are right now, right? What happens
now? You did it.
It broke it. All right.
It is there. Says detail for RB3 and it didn't come.
Yeah, but maybe it's the old version of the file.
Why? There's something not. There's something moving. Because they were working just fine about me. Yeah. So let me make sure.
So something. So just. While we're looking at this one real quick,
Go back to RB2.
So we needed 2 feet to get into one. So on that low point, that lowest one scale on that, what are we talking about? Is that about a foot or something?
That's around a foot. Yeah. And by the way, you're going the opposite direction right now, right? We all can agree that we're going this way. In groundwater levels. We don't have the current year's modeling, but it was still an above average rain year and likely to continue to be on that rising trend. Right? So you're going that direction. So what that in generally speaking, what we are talking about is not a single one of these monitoring wells right now meets the stage one requirements in current conditions. Conditions would have to deteriorate in order for you to get there.
Maybe
four of them. Bring up just the hydrograph, and you would need four of them in order to get there.
Four polygons.
You have to meet the step one to get to the step one. Right? Bring the RB, the three one, sorry.
This one?
Yeah. So can you just zoom in so we get that bottom corner right there? Yeah, there we go. Just pull that down. So same thing here. The amplitude is significantly larger, right? This is like a 25-foot total amplitude annual average, right? And that means that you're talking in these 5-foot increments for the status, right? So right now, if you look at where the water levels are, and by the way, this only shows 23s, not 24s water area. So it's actually 2 steps higher in the low. You might look at this and say, well, this one qualifies now. It does not currently. The water level is high enough where it would not qualify for step one. However, if you look at that point down there, and that's that 2021, 2022 low periods, right? They're down below the MT. So you could technically have a scenario by which step one through five is not done yet, meaning you haven't even reached the lowest step in the monetary portion of it, and you still reach the secondary process, which is to restrict you when you go below the MT, right? It says, Only then is there a restriction, and that says that you cannot pump greater than the safe yield, I mean the sustainable yield, which is the average of all the safe yields within of all of the polygons within that area, common area. So you're averaging this thing three separate times in order to get to a condition under which you put the action in place, right? You have to have multiple of the individual wells reach the stage in which the action occurs. You have to have an overall average of all of the polygons put together create a safe and then sustainable yield that makes that floor line of volume. That's the secondary average section, right? And then you're also using a, how would I best describe this? Losing my mind. You're also creating, so you have your average of all the locations, your multiple locations in one making it happen. And because there are multiple ways in which it can happen, steps versus restrictions, you have to have, you're not always going to have the money restrictions go into place in full prior to the floor happening. So you can have a situation like this one where almost all of the range, annual range, is still above the MT, but the fall low is below the MT and it meets that restriction requirement for round two, type two restriction. Bring the the whole document back up. The text.
Text. For the other one?
That, the word document, that one right there that's in your background. That one right there.
The RV3?
Nope. RV3. I want the text, the management. Nope. You just had it up. The actual Word document.
There.
So scroll down all the way to the bottom so we get the last management action.
The floor?
Keep going. Nope, right there. Management action number two. Management action number two is independent of management action number one. Meaning, you could literally have a scenario where you have a large amplitude, right, year over year. However, it's below the MT, so it triggers that secondary action. But it hasn't even triggered. I mean, technically, it could be that it hasn't even triggered any of the other steps, but that's really unlikely. And that doesn't exist that I can see anywhere. But you could, this is an entirely independent action from number one. So, but also, this requires multiple RMS wells to be in there over multiple years. So this isn't like we just had where it goes in, in. That does not trigger this. It has to go ding, 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 ding in order for this to be triggered. So we're talking about long-term overdraft causing a condition in which our fall lows remain below the MT for multiple seasons in a row, contiguously.
And this triggers a monetary penalty or
this is the fixed penalty, which means if it's then it requires you to pump no more than the sustainable yield, which is the average of all the safe yields from every polygon within it. So if you're looking at this, right, the sustainable yield is the average of all the calculated safe yields of each of these individual polygons. And so you don't take one polygon and have it be the set pumping rate for all of the area. You're averaging that. And that allows that a bumper, right? So that you don't have an instantaneously effect based on one polygon having a strange year, whatever it might be, or a localized effect, or anything of that nature. You're allowing it to average out across the entire month. Right now, right in the conditions we are in, there is not a single polygon, there's not a single area within the Red Bluff subbasin that would have any triggered actions in the condition we are currently in.
How do we address overdraft?
But you will, because we're going the right way right now. We're going to rise from lot levels. If we were 2023 right now, 2022 right now, there would be some that are in there.
Okay.
Does that make sense? It's just a right. We've had three real rain years in a row, and we're now not in that low point anymore.
So if we're in that low point, what would that do though? That tells him he's not pumping anymore, or he's just going to pay more.
So number one is pay more, right? Action one means every one of those steps increases the policy.
But what will that do? You're taking money from them, but what will that actually?
That's the benefit for courage for.
Actually, it's more than just that.
You did the pockets.
Actually, it's more than that, just that, right? What it does is there are two separate programs that we're funding up here, right? One is this punitive measure, and one is this voluntary measure. But that voluntary measure is incentivized. It needs funding to create a way to incentivize people to do the actions, right? That's the funding source for not all, but more concentrated funding source in that area in order to get the action. This is incentivizing people to increase efficiency, to report actual data on use. This is an important one. There is no mandatory reporting on use. All of our programs are assumed volume per acre on crop type. But mandatory reporting then benefits those who use less water than that volumetric assumption. And it allows us to suggest efficiencies for them to create efficiencies that reduce their use, and that activity can be incentivized with money.
But will you ever tell them if they get up off water?
That's the second part.
If they have the ability to.
Action two is the actual restriction. It makes it a crime to pump greater than the sustainable yield. And that crime has a $500 fine associated with it per acre foot. So you are breaking the law by going over, and there is a penalty to do so.
But if they're going to keep trees alive, they're going to do that.
Possibly. But I'm going to tell you, no one's going to do it for very long when your water starts costing you a couple thousand bucks per acre foot. You get a couple seasons in a row of doing that, people are going to start making different financial decisions, right?
They're going to go bang.
They're going to go, you will drive people. That's right.
You will eventually pay them to see that happening for us.
But there isn't another, you ultimately, the other option is to just put restrictions based on sustainable yield now, like many of these other basins that we're talking about, Duncan, the ones that are starting to put in place, literally just setting a sustainable yield and saying, that's your number. And that creates a different type of issue where there is an immediate effect, right? Where people are downsizing. And the smaller players are coming out of the market because they get bought up in order to have their water be used.
All right, I'm going to do.
So we're talking about trade-offs here.
So you're setting up Chevron to buy out all the little guys here.
That's right. And this methodology.
So that I didn't like.
This is not this. This is not this. This is the opposite. This helps incentivize the small guy, increase their efficiency, and lower their costs in the long run. And lessen the risk that they go bankrupt.
Time check, Jessica. I don't want to cut off this conversation, but I just want to check in with the group and Justin. I know you had two others. One of them, the RB5 detail, those are still wonky. So
is the RB6 detail one?
RB6 one is working.
All right, so, we'll pull that one. So, the main and the detail, we'll talk about that too.
So just want to double check with folks. Like, is this group okay with going? Keep on going. All right.
As opposed to what?
Yeah. No, just break.
We're done.
What time is the meeting adjourned?
Cool. You got a half an hour.
And Stephanie and Justin, working group, I do have to drop off. I've been listening. I missed maybe the last couple of minutes, but you know, this is all important discussion. And I think some of the things that we laid out in that work framework document are helpful for some of the issues that we're discussing here.
Thanks so much, Duncan.
Thank you.
All right, thanks, everybody.
All right. So RB6U. So this is a Rancho Tejeda. RB6Q. So you can see here, significant drop, but our MO and our MT are down here. So
they go down as far down as you're.
Yeah, it's, yeah, it does. Yeah, it does. A little bit down by you.
Well, that's the one for me, yeah.
Yeah,
we have. You know,
I was just trying to figure out where.
Okay, I know where
you're at. So this guy right here, as you can see, has a hard drop line with a significant drop down to the MT. Can you pull up that detail for this one? So average spring to fall is only 5 feet. This might be deceiving because there's a couple of really big drops in there, but the actual average spring to fall amplitude over the entire duration is approximately 5 feet. What's that?
Over 20 years.
Yeah, so it has a tendency to do this, every once in a while does this, and this. So it makes it look like that amplitude is getting skewed, but the actual average is only around 5 feet.
What does the amplitude have to do with the situation?
Yeah.
It's the bottom number.
Here's why. Yeah, I'll explain that. So there were two situations in groundwater management that created a problem, right? This, right, where you're steadily just going downhill, and this, where your amplitude gets larger at this bottom end, continues to cause problems, undesirable results at that bottom side. Both of those things are issues. It does not matter how high you get in the spring. If in the fall, you drop below everybody's well, they're all
right. Right.
So as you increase amplitudes, you also increase the likelihood of undesirable results. So this takes into account both of those scenarios, right? Both this continuous decline and drop and this widening of amplitude that causes undesirable results at that bottom fall measure. So, because if you think about it this way, you could, and let's just use the example of recharge. Right, you recharge your spring measurement way up, right? Over the winter, you get tons and tons of water, you recharge, but you're pumping so much out of that basin that it drops your fall number way back down. I'm not saying this is happening somewhere right now. I'm just talking about possibilities that could occur. You drop that fall measurement way back down. It literally doesn't matter how high you got the spring.
That's his point.
Because you're still pumping.
So why does the amplitude matter? It's the bottom is all that matters.
Because it's percentage of amplitude that's below your target. How far you are away from your goal. So what we're setting up right here is a program by which it costs you more money to pump water as you get farther and farther away from your goal. And when you meet the restricted point that says, we know for sure right here, we are causing people problems. That's our MT, right? We are saying, we go below that, we are failing. Then there is a strict restriction on volume associated with sustainable yield.
Bill, that was good.
Because every well has a different variable for how much water is being used. And as you get farther and farther away from your goal on that bottom, right, that is the trigger. If you look at this right here, reading of 1 foot below MO is at 1 foot. Reading of 2 foot below MO is at 2. The reason why we use the amplitude is to determine how far away we are from where we want to be,
Bill,
right, in this scale.
Bill, walk us through the scenario that you're concerned with, just so that way we can better understand what the concern you have related to the amplitude.
Well, I get accused of using my own.
No, it's you're
the way. Part of this building, our mansion, it's always been over 20%. Clear back 20 years ago, was
20%.
Yes, yeah. Why do we base
the bottom. It's still the bottom.
No, but option or number one and number two and number three is all based on the difference between the top
it's
and the
based
bottom.
On how far it is below your goal. I know that we're talking about amplitude in the sense that so water normally goes up and down year to year to year. In some places it goes a lot, and in some places it goes a little. If you just set a strict number below your MO, it doesn't take into account the flexibility of that movement. If you do it by percentage of that movement, it takes into account how much they move each year in every different area. If you don't do that and you just set a strict number, you are saying, right, no matter what happens, no matter how this well works, that's the number that you are restricting to. We are trying to build in enough flexibility that says, hey, in this area, this water moves a lot. We know that, right? It moves a ton. And so we are taking that into consideration in our program. A percentage of that movement has to be down below our goal in order for us to take an action.
Justin, I have the
RV5 hydrographic. I mean, I'm sure. I'm sure. Do you write this right? You're
trying to soften it. You're trying to soften it. I get that. Just soften it.
Exactly.
That's not what I would call
a broad, you know, spring to fall change. I mean, we're 30, 35.
Yeah, yeah.
That's for me. That's a good performing aquifer.
And by the way, that's not a problem. It's just the only problem is how far we get away from our goal. And you want to take into account how dynamic the area is. They all have different levels of dynamicness.
I get what you're saying. I think part of my problem is the way, you know, when we set the MOs and everything, the MOs specifically, it's like, oh, don't worry about that. You can be below that. And so I don't think there was a lot of thought given to, you know, this. So now
what's that? That's an excellent point, by the
yeah.
way. And I want to talk about,
I mean, I was there and I just don't think it was really,
no, I think good. It's really important.
And
yeah.
So that's why I had made the comment, why don't you tie it to MTs?
Well, let me just explain this, because the MT has its own issues associated with setting those numbers. And the MO, which you're regulating towards the goal, allows you the flexibility of incorporating how far it's going below your goal into your restrictive action. Bill, let me give you an example of this. Bill came into my office the other day. I'm sorry to let you know. I don't think it's okay to talk about this. And he said, look, man, you look at the hydrograph that's by me right here. This is going to be a mess for me because the MO, because of where the MO is, right? It's the only one in all of these hydrographs where the MO is routinely, where the duration, right, the amplitude is routinely falling below the MO.
Justin, is that RV5?
It is not, oh. And I don't have it on here. Oh. We can bring it up on the, will you bring up our groundwater site, or total one, and I'll show you.
I think you'll see that quite a few polygons.
It's actually many less than you think.
In the 27s.
Yeah, well, we're going to talk about the 27 race in a lot of ways, but we'll just keep going. The reason why this is built the way that it is, where we don't take any action over the 5-year period, is so that we can get it right. Because A, all of these RMS RMPs do not currently have MOs and MT set up. We're going to have to do that. And in these few areas where we discovered that there's an issue with where the MO was set, because it was set on a parameter that's not necessarily the correct parameter, we're going to have to make some changes. And that includes Bill's, the one that's on Bill's property. Because the MO is in the middle of the amplitude forever. Why is our goal there? It doesn't make sense when I look at it. All the rest of the goals, the MO is somewhere below the amplitude, right? Where you're saying, we want to stay above this level. This works great. And every once in a while, there's a problem and you go below it.
All right,
Justin,
so which one do you want?
It is right. Let's zoom in a little bit more. I think it is that one.
Don't clean up.
All right. There we go. So this is what the issue that we're talking about. So we need to work. This is an MO issue, what we're looking at right here, right? It's pretty clear to me that this MO isn't in the right place.
The most green line.
Yeah. Our goal should not be above the area that it generally is. That doesn't make any sense. We're going to have to fix that. If you look at all of the other hydrographs and all the ones that I just showed you, our water levels generally remain above the MO. Right? That makes sense. right? Generally, you're above your goal. When you have a problem, you fall below your goal. This well, that is not true, man.
That's on Bill's place?
Yeah.
I mean, that looks like a lot of. What is the scale there?
Okay, read it.
That's a, what, 30?
The top of the
yeah, 30 to 40 foot.
30 to 40
foot. Amplitude
on groundwater, that's only the average is 45 feet below ground surface.
Yeah. So your MO needs to be lowered to accommodate the reality of this well site, right? I don't, whatever map that we set to set these MOs obviously is imperfect, just like everything we ever do, right? And during this 5-year period, we are going to be setting practical MOs and MTs for the ones that we don't have them in yet, and creating practical MOs and MTs, potentially MTs. I think MTs are probably close to okay. MOs in particular in areas that have this issue, which, by the way, is not very common. I looked through them all already. It is not terribly common. There's just a few.
But if we left it like this, Bill would be in trouble a lot.
Bill would be in trouble a lot. Needlessly. This is normal operation.
Yeah,
right. This is normal.
So the MOs need to be changed before we agree upon a plan, because otherwise it's a leap of faith open that
No, you just say that it has to be adjusted within a 5-year
period.
And it's on purpose.
How do you justify that for the first let go? So Bill gets to drop his area down just because.
Now, what you do is you justify it based on the historical record, right? All of these units typically have an MO that's a few feet to a percentage of the range below the standard operating range, right? So it runs down here somewhere below this range. This one, whatever that map that we used, did not put it there. It probably has to do with the shallowness of wells in the area. If I had to guess, there's very shallow groundwater here, and therefore a lot of wells that are very shallow. And if you remember during the MO calculations, part of the consideration for setting MOs was the elevation of those wells. We already know that that data is problematic, right? Some of those wells that we use don't even actually exist anymore. And so we need to adjust this to the more practical, reasonable sense that normally the water operates within this range. Our target should be to stay against that normal range. The vast majority of subbasins and GSAs that I have looked at set their MOs based on some historical data, not based on in the fact that a well would or would not go dry. Because you can't, the well data is too poor. Does that make sense? It's just not good enough. You can't say, based on a 1920s well log that someone found somewhere, that it's accurate for ground level at a baseline water level. They're just not that good. And sometimes someone just wrote something in there because it didn't matter in 1920. You know what I mean? Hey, we run around 40 feet.
A lot of, there it is. You know, at least according to subjects, speaking to Red Lab, you know, I was in on the CSAP meetings, and, you know, the MTs even, well, I think they'd like to see another 5 feet. Well, that's not based on anything that's real.
Yep.
It's just, you know, anytime you get into a situation where you're trying to read some regulatory reviewer's mind,
yep,
do something based on that. But there's mistakes and mistake that
you're building in risk needlessly. I mean, that's true. And so here, let me just put it this way. That's why we are going to have a forced review of this on 5-year cycles. We're going to get more data. We're going to see what's happening in the real world, and then we're going to be required. That is that flexibility that we need to have built in so that we don't just continue to make a mistake. You are required to review it on 5-year intervals. Does that make sense? Build it right into the regulation. So ultimately, it doesn't set up a situation by which that you guys are worried about, which I entirely get because I've had these things happen to me, where a regulation, right, is really not that valid to the situation. But because of the way the regulation is written, it causes a problem. If you force it to be reviewed in these intervals, it allows that to change naturally. And it requires it to change naturally.
So that is why, that's really why I'm trying to do this. I mean, really, that is, I know that we need to have something in place that sets parameters by which if too much water is used, there's a consequence.
Yeah.
Right?
I mean, it has to be built in that.
That's what everybody's saying. Ultimately, there is no desirable way to do that. I think we can all agree on that too. Every way you do it sucks for somebody. The reason why I am proposing that we do this way is it allows a lot of feedback loop, a lot of opportunity for change, and builds in automatic changes based on the conditions. So this thing automatically changes based on the conditions. You don't even need to change the regulation, it just happens. And so that way, you are not having people in a political position making a decision about what happens to your water based on a change in conditions. It's already written into the regulations, it happens by itself without that outside exterior input. So it's the reason why I want you guys to think about this in a really big way. It's important to me, at least, to build regulation that allows for that type of flexibility.
So will that?
And by the way, it's more work for me.
The redefining of polygons and reshaping of polygons or adding the number of polygons, is that all built in?
Yeah, so exactly. And as you create more, so we're drilling new wells. You know this all the time. To monitor. As you create those, you'll automatically build a new polygon around those based on that thesis system, and it will automatically be built into the program.
Well, one of the concerns I've had is that, you know, out of those 8 polygons within that 2.5 area, for example, if 4 of them keep kicking us into a problem,
yeah,
chronically,
yeah,
then there's a good argument to say, okay, maybe we should include all of these in the same grouping.
That's right.
Because I'm concerned that you're going to be imposing restrictions on the river area numbers
when it's something totally different.
Just when yeah, mathematically, it's others that are kicking us into that.
And well, right now it looks like those are acting similarly. That could be by coincidence. We don't actually know that, right? It could be by coincidence. But of course they do, but it also could be by coincidence that they're in a similar pattern right now, right? As things change and conditions change over time, those patterns might draw away from each other, like you said. This one's having a lot more issues, this one's having less. The math that's built into what creating well, how these get bunched together accounts for that automatically. It will automatically change because it's about the condition. The groundwater level condition is the big multiplier there. So it just literally will bunch them together in a different category every 5 years. And the reason why I recommend 5-year periods is so people have at least something. You don't want to just be like every year, really, sorry, we change this on you. Sorry, we change this on you. Sorry, we change this on you. That's a problem in its own way.
Yeah. Almost 10:20. So, Justin, what are the next steps with all of this?
Yeah. So, right now, I am working with a series of existing agencies, RCD and a couple others, that provide programs that do things like give free monitoring, give efficiency advice for free, do all of these different soil testing and monitoring processes. I'm sure many of you guys already use some of these services.
Nothing's free. Who's paying for that?
Okay. Well, right now it's the state of California.
Okay.
But ultimately, what will happen is they get very money throughout time, right? Their income sources change. What we want to do is not create a brand new program because that's costly. But we do want, they have all of the mobile labs, all of the knowledge, everything built in, these different local agencies do. We want to tap them to provide them a funding source when problems occur to increase this incentivized behavior of being more efficient. What we do know for sure is that a significant percentage of current irrigated agriculturalists still do not use these methodologies and these prescriptions.
But you're talking about like Kevin Greer and his group.
Correct.
They're already funded. And
So here's the bits with this. And I've had some meetings with them already.
Yes, they have some funding to do some of these services, and they are limited. However, one of their biggest problems is telling people how it benefits them and getting it to occur. And when you incentivize a behavior by saying, hey, you do this, it saves you money. Oh, and we will pay for all of it, not just this portion of it that's going to be stupid, right? Then you will create a natural way by which a higher and higher percentage of people will be doing this over time. And you will lower the total demand for groundwater, increasing how much water is available in those safe yield and sustainable yield calculations. That, by the way, more inputs is still important. Recharge in lieu, that's important too. Every single one of those drops that you replace is a direct, right, change to the math in groundwater level change, because it's going to extract less groundwater. So it's a huge benefit. If we can get there to where we get, instead of 40% of people doing this, you get 60, 70, 80% of people doing this, and also 15% of their total groundwater. That's a huge pool of water right there. It's just a big pool that's sitting there that does not require restrictions.
You could do it the other way too. My experience with those evaluations has been that most growers are under-applying water. And as a result of that, they improve their irrigation practices for the crop, but they're above them more.
That depends.
They're not matching ET, they're not even close.
Well, according to that is not necessary.
I've seen it on the ground.
Yeah, it depends on where you are. And yes, there are specific circumstances where that happens. But there are many, many, many that are the only. Yeah. So ultimately, if you're the most efficient that you possibly can in using water, you use less. That's one of those big incentivized programs. That's not the only one, right? When we start talking about incentives, you know, you saw the list that I gave. Ultimately, when we do this and put this in place, people are going to have to prove it, unless it's like literally just a reduction in a plant that's irrigated. And so that's going to require some sort of metering and monitoring to make it happen to prove it. But hopefully over time, we convince people that it's in their best interest to report their water use, because it's going to be less than a sign. All of this together combined creates less use out of the basin, more water available for us to use when we get into harder times. Right, and a super flexible system that changes as conditions change in the varied patterns, and as we get more data, automatically. And that's the goal of this outcome.
On the graph that's up there right now, can you expand that anymore? You see the left hand side?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, just looking at that magenta line. It looks like such a good well, but that magenta line is telling us otherwise.
That's right. That's that fall, right? Where you're saying, hey, but look at this.
That's built on the spring beat.
Yeah. And here's a little bit of the problem with that. Let me just a laser pointer with me.
You're tall.
I know. Well, you've got a cool well over there. They've been on it 70 years.
Bill's general legislation is totally right. You look at sort of this average kind of falls generally between these two points. That's the amplitude we're talking about. There are occasions where you have problems. Let's not debate that. It happens, right? You get not enough rain for a couple years in a row, it's not falling down below. That scenario right there should not be what causes a restriction to go in place. Well, I think we all agree that that's true. So if we buffer this out over multiple years and average it across multiple basins, that creates a scenario by which that does not occur. That is your city. And by the way, this MO is in the wrong spot. So we have to fix that problem too. It's going to have to be down here somewhere where it's actually supposed to be. Because this appears by my calculation to be normal. And the MO, our goal should be to keep it normal.
So, Justin, what's the next steps for this group? And kind of thinking also, like, we have the August 6th meeting. What do you anticipate talking about at that meeting? And what would you like to occur in between?
I need to know what you need to know to move something forward. I mean, that's it.
if there's something you know, like if you want Eddie to come in to talk about how these things get created and the nuances of that, I'll have him come in. What I want to impress on everybody is we want to get a programmatic setup in front of our board next year, right? And in order to do that, we're going to have to make some decisions. And by the way, no such thing as a good decision when we're talking about restriction. We all agree and we all know, right? We have a certain amount of data. We have what we have and are going to have to make decisions on it. We have the ability to create a program that changes automatically and does cost restrictions needlessly when conditions change. So I just want to stress upon us that I think we can do this, and this appears to be a very doable thing, but we are going to have to move something along. And at some point, we're going to have to lament and say, we know that our data is not perfect. Here's the best we can do right now, and this is what the program should look like. Let's build in those protections automatically so that we don't, so that we can make adjustments in the future.
Well,
that's what I meant.
As far as funding goes, is your plan to come up with a budget to present to the commission? Sorry, I need to talk about it.
Yeah, we're not going to talk budget in here. This isn't the budget here. This is the demand.
So if we go to the commission and you.
That's right. Commission and then board.
I talk about outreach, and the first question you're going to get is, what's going to cost me?
That's right.
And I'm trying to put it together.
Yep. I purposely committed a schedule for looking at these things and creating budgetary requirements in our last commission meeting, because I wanted it to follow the timeline that I think this needs to go into place so that people can understand at the same time, A, what's my exposure, and B, how much is it going to cost me? What's my risk? How much is it going to cost me? And so that we can talk about those things at the same time. Because, I mean, that's ultimately, you know, someone that's making a business decision about how they're going to proceed with something, if you hold them out, right, that's a risk to them in itself.
So we talked about some additions, language, with house concerns with in-lieu and recharge numbers. Potential?
Yeah.
Are we going to get that incorporated before the next meeting?
So two things. This document that we're looking at that's coming from that group is not the plan that is going to get passed by the board. Those are two separate things. That's an informative document. Right, and the plan that gets passed by the board is the actual program.
But it needs to be a line item.
And I'm with you. We can absolutely do that, and we can, by the way, continue to refine that for as long as we want to, and it will inform our decision making as we make changes on our 5-year
update. And the other I am concerned with, and maybe this is I need to spend more time reading, was the definition of terms with respect to sustainable versus safe. Ian's concerns that he voiced in the email, that we looked at all that, or
we're going to do that call for you. We are talking about that right now. We're going to go through and make absolutely sure. We have a couple of different problems. We have two different plans sections generated by two different groups of people with two different, some little bits of two different languages. So we're going to figure that out a little bit.
Example of what we're working on is trying to identify the terms that folks have said are confusing, identifying, you know, where is this a DW, is this a state term, or is this this group's terminology, and we're trying to define it, get a definition, and a better understanding. So
just define it, use it consistently, and I'll be happy.
That's all. Yeah, that's all. And by the way, for this document, before it goes to board meeting, voting body is going to have all of the terms that are specific to the document defined in front of the document. So I'm going to commit to spending the time to making sure that we do that, because I agree with you guys. If you get to read up front what it is, it saves us a whole bunch of hassle in a meeting. People going, what does this even mean? So hopefully that will help.
Then on your straw deal, we were going to talk about that around time, but
yeah.
So I want to see some of the stuff loosened up.
They said, what are you gonna do about leases? Somebody wants to retire and they get a guy down the street to do his farming for him. I mean, the way that's written, that's
out. The way that's written, a lease is out. And let me just put it to you this way. So one of the things that is problematic with this is ultimately there's going to be a cutoff on when the district manages. And we're all going to have to make a decision about how much you want to manage, because those individually have costs. Every time you add something like, is it contiguous pieces of property, that all we do is look at the APN numbers of the owners who bunch together in a group that's relatively automated. That's a fairly easy system to put in place to manage. As properties sell, we actually get the reports directly from the county. We change those blocks automatically. That stuff is relatively, relatively simple. When you start implementing things that require other formats of inputs, right, into that document, that increases the cost and the bureaucracy.
I get that, but you're going to have major trouble if you start.
So we just need to make sure. And by the way, I'm not saying no, that's not what I mean. I'm saying there's going to have to be a decision made about where that stuff gets cut off and how much it's worth to make those things happen. So if you're saying to me, if everybody's sitting in this room agrees, hey, we need to have a program for reporting leases into the blocks, say it. Well, I'll make a program that does it. I don't mind that. I just want you all to be aware of the trade-off. So you're saying, okay, we all want our fees to be a little higher, but we do want this lease program to put in place. And if everybody, if there's a consensus in this group that does it, I'll write that up.
I don't know that I'd call it a program. You know, basically, you got a list, right? And this APN and this APN, they're not contiguous. And this APN is going to be farmed by the same guy. Mm-hmm. All what you're trying to do is reduce within the sustainable yield area, reduce the water use. What does it matter if they're contiguous, not contiguous, if it's the guy down the street doing the farming?
By the way, I do not have a preference.
I'm just saying.
I just heard different a point of views from this group. One point of view of, hey, look, the problem with that is that you might be concentrating all of the water right here and not over here. And you call this RMS well to have a huge problem. Don't operate in this one over here, right? You have this issue. Localized problems.
I get that.
And so I just say that, once again, I need some, there has to be some sort of like generalized consensus that says, hey, you know what, we think that's a great idea, bring that in front of me. Or we don't think that's a great idea, don't bring that in front of me. I don't want to like do a lot of things and do these huge lifts of something that is literally just going to be like, hell no, we don't want to do that. So tell me, I understand what you're saying and I don't disagree. I just want there to be some sort of like, hey, we agree, let's do that.
So immediate next steps are we're going to get these hydrographs and details. We'll figure out those two documents that were wonky. We'll get that out to you immediately. And the request is for you all to review, provide your feedback to really, really help inform the August 6th. And it sounds like what we're looking for is for this group to get to as much of a consensus on what you want to then the ad hoc members. We're going to be making recommendations to the Groundwater Commission. So that's like the order of those discussions and things like that. So the more that you can get that to us beforehand, the more we'll have like be able to really delve in and identify what are the issues that need to be fleshed out more. All right.
Did that make sense?
Did you, the follow-up from the request from the last meeting?
Which one?
I don't know, you've got them. There was a request for some follow-up on some items. I just wondered if we've got that. Yeah.
That's what this is. There was a request to see the actual data that Grump bunches put together. That's getting sent to you, and that's what this is.
And then the map, I think we had a request for the map that you can see the boundaries on, right? When you pull this stuff up, that's hard to see. I remember that. Somebody
put it in an overlay on Google.
Yeah. I will send out the instructions of how to do that on the map. Do you want it in a paper map, email it to you?
I think.
Or do you want to do it on your own map that you have on me? I can show you how to do it.
Either way.
Okay, I'll send you off the instructions about how to do that on this map.
Then remember, you had a note for just some explanation on the justification on how the this 2.5 number, say, fuel was.
That's just data, and I can go over it again really quick if you guys want.
Will you bring up that Excel spreadsheet with it?
All right.
That's it.
Since that's an
extra. It's actually, by the way, like 2.9 in real figures, by the way. I just rounded things off, but it puts it to give you an idea. But the actual raw number is right here.
And those are available where?
Oh, let me go back over here. You're going to get an email to you right now. So, right after this meeting, my goal was to show you this data today. Scroll down a little bit. Keep going down. So, there's your 2.5 number. So, it actually, the actual math is 2.9. This is the calculated safe yield in each of the polygons in that grouping. This is the average, which creates the sustainable yield for the total management area. Does that make sense? So average of each one of the polygons, I mean, the total of each one of the polygons, average creates the sustainable yield.
For the that group.
For that zone. And that zone.
That zone being all those polygons.
That's right. And that zone changes based on the math associated with total volume available within the polygon, and will change automatically over time. So this calculation is infinitely flexible technically on a 5-year period.
Okay, and one other request is I think you were going to give us an update on outside legal counsel.
I'm going to do that. The problem is I really want to give them something that is not going to change dramatically, right? So it's cost money, of course, to have legal counsel reviews up. Let's get our stuff nubbed down as well as we can.
I'm going to let that. Who's legal counsel?
BKS.
And who's the lead on that?
Well, there's actually three, so I don't know. Who's it? Who specifically will take this?
Sacramento.
They are out of Sacramento?
Yep. Mr. B, Mr. K.
Hopefully the K guy stays in it, or we got a weird little
All right, we are a few minutes over and we're rapidly losing folks who are listening in. So I'm gonna close out today's meeting. Next meeting is August 6th in the morning. For folks online, these materials are available on the website, as well as we'll post a audio recording. Thanks all for listening in longer, and I'll see you next time.